usually been operating the conversations is by sort of reading over the air the set of problems or questions that I set out in the email inviting people to come. And then when it's a small group, it's really helpful because everybody can sort of go around and talk about their work and how it intersects with the topic, maybe throw out a couple things you might want to talk about. And then I just sort of open it up for discussion and hope for the best. Usually it's been pretty good, especially when the group is like under 10. When the groups get too big, people get rid of their I desire for participation and they want one or two people to dominate. So smaller groups are better.
How long will this go on?
Probably about an hour. Looks like Carl has somewhere to be.
No. I've turned in my clubs.
Okay. All right. This is the little intro that I wrote. At a time when pundits' labels usually follow the word Christian with conservative, how can people continuing in the line of Christian social justice work carve out space for themselves in the world of media representation, the popular imagination, and movements dominated by secular activists, who are often suspicious, if not outright hostile, to anyone who describes him or herself as Christian? How does faith, and particularly Christianity, motivate existing actions for social justice? How might different Christians in different traditions define social justice differently? How does that affect how different Christians can work with each other, as well as with secular activists? So, for my little intro, it's kind of odd for me to be organizing a conversation like this because I'm not Christian. And in some ways, one might see it as doing penance because for to use a very Christian word, for most of my teens and 20s, I was one of those people who was pretty skeptical, if not outright hostile. And it's only been in the last 4 years or so that
really
started to change. My mother is an Episcopalian and an activist, and I think it was always very, very difficult. It was one of the sources of tension over the years between us. So I'm sort of wanting to organize this to try it out and to hear what other people have to say. I had initially wanted to have this happen last weekend so that my mother could actually come because she was in town. So I'll turn over the mic.
Just
introduce yourself and work and why you're here.
Well, my name is Jeff Trask. I'm an associate pastor of New Covenant Fellowship. It's on the corner of Randolph and White. I've been there for about 3 years as the Mercy and Justice pastor. I'm actually quite involved in a number of different projects taking place in town for the sake of helping the poor and helping those that are in need. So that's kind of where I'm at right now.
I'm Carl Esterbrook. I'm a wandering scholar. My wanders have been fairly stable for the last 15 years since I've lived in Champaign-Urbana for that time, but that's not because of my particular work. I did a degree in history of Christian thought, not because it was a program that was even particularly recognized, but just because there were some questions that I was interested in and wanted to answer. Things about theology and social transformation primarily, and I started off doing that in an academic way, associated with it in some other ways too. But at the heart of it has always been the question of what I thought theologically and what I thought should be done politically. So they've been bound up from early on.
And my name's Kevin Hamilton. I'm here first as a fan of the project, and I've been wanting to come to one of these. It's the first one I've gotten to attend in person. And I teach in the School of Art and Design here, so I've been aware of this project and its formation. But also, I'm particularly interested in today's topic. I think I am Christian, and I think my background of struggling with the relationship of the work I do as an artist, as a teacher, to my faith has been an ongoing question for all my life. So, and especially, I think that question has really influenced where my work has gone, my artwork especially, and where it ends up locating itself, I think. So, pass it on.
My name is Steve Shoemaker, and I'm a Presbyterian minister. That's one of the Protestant Christian denominations, and currently I'm director of the University YMCA. on this campus that has a Christian background, although at the moment it's probably more secular than Christian in terms of most of our programs. I was one of the pastors at McKinley Presbyterian Church here on this campus, which has been here a long time and has a long history of supporting progressive social movements. I can talk more about some of them later, maybe.
Hi, I'm Eric Anglada. I'm a member of the St. Jude Catholic Worker community. We operate a soup kitchen and we house homeless women and children. I would say the Catholic Worker is kind of trying to incarnate the Gospels. Like, taking three, for instance, would be so. So.
Well, I didn't get anyone really specifically talking about how they wanted to start the conversation. So I think probably definitions are good to get out of the way early on in any consideration of a topic. And I think what is most difficult in talking about, say, progressive Christianity is what that would even mean. It seems that in a lot of what one might think of as like liberal or progressive politics, they're almost litmus test issues, and those are things that are potentially most divisive for people who describe themselves as Christian. Things like are good to get out of the way early on in any consideration of a topic. And I think what is most difficult in talking about, say, progressive Christianity is what that would even mean. It seems that in a lot of what one might think of as like liberal or progressive politics, they're almost litmus test issues, and those are things that are potentially most divisive for people who describe themselves as Christian, things like abortion or gay rights. So I was wondering how you think about those kinds of questions, those really, not necessarily personally if you don't want to share your politics on that, but what the role of those kinds of litmus test issues might be, or how you could define progressive Christianity.
Yeah. Right. I would use the label radical, because a guy named Mike Baxter, who's a theologian, kind of distinguishes progressive versus radical in saying, well, if there's homeless people, if there's hungry people, the progressives say, march on City Hall. The radicals say, well, let's feed them. And so it's kind of the direct action kind of idea of it. And it's also, for me in the Catholic Worker, in radical Christianity, it's looking outside of the locus of the nation state. It's seeing the church having its own politics. Call that anarchist. I think the church has its own politics that, you know, right now it has its own politics. Politically is within the, you know, the spectrum of conservative, liberal, within, you know, voting, legislation, stuff like that. And so the Catholic Worker is sort of, and I, idea is that we do it ourselves. We don't look to the government. And becoming radical, countercultural, alternative, it can be a true witness to so anyone kind of comment on that?
Well, I'll be happy to respond. This is Steve. I wonder, though, doesn't the Catholic Worker movement go beyond just meeting the immediate need of the poor? Wouldn't you also consider it important to attack some of the structures that lead to poverty, create poverty, almost ensure poverty, homelessness, hunger? Because that's very important to me. I celebrate what the Catholic Worker House does in terms of feeding feeding the hungry and providing a place of shelter for the homeless. And I've certainly been involved in some of those issues during my life too. But it seems to me if we don't go farther and analyze what are causing some of the problems and try to attack those, and maybe that's not too strong of a word. I don't know what label to put on it. But
no, that's good. That's yeah, there's that other side to it as well. I mean, for instance, I consider part of my work is, you know, the peacemaking. Recognizing what's happening in Iraq is, you know, how many billions of dollars being spent to kill people. And Iraq could be used for, you know, for the common good in this country. And so, that's all part of it as well. And, I mean, Dorothy Day was big into labor organizing. So, yeah, we're not only trying to meet those needs directly, we're also questioning why those needs are there in the first place. So
something like racism that keeps many people from being able to be employed enough to provide for themselves and their family would be an example of that.
But this is Kevin. I would want to make a distinction between people who I have recognized as seeking to go to the root of the problem still through their own maybe countercultural means, and then I would sort of set that against those who try to get involved perhaps in an existent state apparatus to try to go to the root of those problems, because some of the radical movements that I would more closely identify myself with would be people like the Mennonites, who would never really get involved in the state means, but they do everything they could to get to the roots through outside.
I wonder about the use of the term progressive Christian that Sarah started with. I think maybe all of us, I assume from brief acquaintance, all of us might say, yes, I would accept that label, and maybe feel a little uncomfortable about precisely what that label means or want to argue about, let me tell you what I think the label means. And as I think about it, I'm almost of the opinion that we might, at the end of the discussion, agree more about what we mean by progressive than what we mean about Christian. I think there may be a very different theological position, more differences in theological position around the, I started to say around the table here, than on progressive, around the blanket, across before we draw the cloth, yeah. Will Rogers once had a wonderful answer when someone asked him what his politics were. And he said, I belong to no organized political party. I am a Democrat. And it seems to me perfect. I have been saying for years now when people ask me my theological opinions, I belong to no organized religion. I'm a Roman Catholic. The point being that the Catholicism, particularly in my lifetime, although it has been presented as a monolithic enterprise, it has been anything but no organized religion at all. So if I try to say something about what the Christian part of progressive Christian means to me, we can come back to the radical reform and the political issues. Christianity, Catholic Christianity in my case, Christianity seems to me to be the announcement of the presence of the kingdom of God. And the political implications of that, I think, mean that Christians, when they begin to think about ethics, which is always a second-order issue for Christians, not the first thing. The preaching of the gospel is not, in the first place, the preaching of ethics at all. The notion is that ethics somehow follow from the preaching of the gospel, or some ethics, or some ethical, usually fairly under for the most part. But that for us, those ethical positions are ineluctably political. Is isolated individualism, that the implications of Christianity are political or communal or joint or, you know, some, there's no individual solution, so to speak. For me, the actual politics that I adapt seem to me to be it would seem to me that a Christian political tradition is to belong a libertarian socialist, use the word anarchist, Eric, would be one that I would adopt. But it seems to me that the Christian position can't sort of rest in that, say, aha, here's what Christianity implies, end of story. What gospel is a good deal beyond that. To take one sort of obvious example, Christianity has always preached that when the kingdom comes in its fullness, everyone participates. The most advanced libertarian socialist, the most careful reading of Marx, knows when pure communism probably finally supervenes, the legions of dead who have not made it will not be included. And that's a fairly fundamental difference.
This is Jeff. One interesting thing I think we'll kind of point out here is this kind of separation idea, and the reality is that it shouldn't be separate in any way, shape, or form. Granted, Christianity probably has perpetuated most of that separatist type of mentality, but it shouldn't be a situation where we have to call ourselves radical to help the poor. It's just a trademark. It's a lifestyle that Jesus led, that as Christians we're leading, following Jesus' example. So it should be something where we're interacting with the communities, we're interacting with the government, we're interacting with everybody, and there is no separate issues out there. It's just that we're all trying to find a common good, and we just, Christians just particularly do that with the motivation that Christ is our guide and our example and our Savior in that sense. But it doesn't mean that we should have any sense of being separate from anything else. And I think that's part of the problem and why people tend to be hostile, and sometimes rightfully so, because this whole mentality of being separate. And I just like to, even just an example that I have with the Christian Health Center that my church and a number of other churches are beginning to start, is that we have many different people from many different backgrounds, and guess what? Not all of them are even Christian. We have physicians and doctors and nurses who are not Christian but want to help people, and we welcome them in. You know, they don't necessarily have to, you know, what their beliefs have to follow that, be in line with that. So,
sectarianism trying to completely distance ourselves and say we're not going to get involved in the world. But I think, you know, unfortunately today, with the church the way it is, I feel like I have to put the label radical in front of Christianity. I have to, that's why I have to say, you know, my Christianity is radical, it's pacifist, and it tends toward anarchism, because today it's not pacifist, it's accommodationist. So I think, you know, the health clinic, a health center, I mean, that, to me, that's Christian politics right there. Setting up something that could be an alternative to the state. Saying how, you know, this is our idea, Christian idea of how to treat others. That's a fundamental part of the Catholic workers. We take this responsibility on ourselves, a personal sacrifice, in order to show how people should live. And in that way, I mean, back to the Old Testament, you know, God calls out Israel to exist for the sake of the whole world, to be this model, to be this alternative culture. And, you know, it's helped transform the world, you know, for good or for ill. Today, I think the potential is there for just an incredible amount of good for Christianity. I think it's about, you know, the Catholic theologians, you know, sitting on the lid of the dynamite that the church has. I mean, to me, the church, because it has Jesus Christ, it's as fundamental as its foundation. And that, to me, I mean, that's dynamite. That's explosive. That's that can change things. But other Christians need to begin to see.
Yeah, take issue with you on a couple things, and maybe I'm surrounded by pacifists here, but
I know you are, Steve.
Okay. I guess what worries me about pacifism is, as a Christian stance, is that for me it doesn't take the problem of evil seriously enough, and it seemed to me that there may be times when not only structures, but structures as they're lived out need to be confronted, and sometimes when evil has enough power, I think the only thing that can limit it is some kind of power in response. And I guess I would argue the other side of your Catholic background, the just war theory. I think occasionally is simply necessary when rulers with power are oppressing huge numbers of people who have no other way out. And I admire pacifists. I admire their purity, but it's not for me.
I got handed. I got handed.
Discussion going here.
It's an important point. No, I really share. I share your concerns there, Stephen. I can think of specific conversations I've been in with people where after I argue long enough for the assimilation of Christianity into Constantine's Rome being the worst thing that ever happened, we eventually get to the point where if I argue that hard enough, then how do we get to the point to where you know, slavery is no longer legal in, supposedly in this country? I mean, that happened out of more than what I think some of the pacifist ways of living that I'm familiar with could have accomplished. So I share those conflicts myself.
In terms of potential for evil, obviously the incorporation of Christianity in Constantine's Rome may be a piker compared to the incorporation of Christianity in George Bush's Washington, but I mean, that's I agree entirely with what Steve was saying about pacifism and the just war tradition. I think that's exactly right. Additions, not even adjustments of what he was saying. The first is that, of course, the just war theory, which he and I would embrace here, begins in pacifism. I mean, the tradition of the just war theory is an attempt to try to delineate those few and rare conditions when the overwhelming demand for peace has, because of exigent circumstances, to be mitigated in some way. So the whole point of just war is that it's not a policy or a program, it's an exception. In fact, the rules of the just war theory all have to be fulfilled for the exception to exist, so to speak. The second thing is that this tradition needs to be taken very seriously indeed, in that a lot of intellectual work has to be done in order to talk about those rules, and it is open to immense amount of propagandizing. There are several very bad books around right now. Well, Mike Novak is an old friend and an old antagonist. We're not friends, but old acquaintance and an antagonist, and he's a very good example.
You have just war theory. Well, it opens it up for this madness.
It does, but I mean, unfortunately, you know, you're not going to keep them out by saying we're not going to talk about those issues. What's her name? Elfstein is even a worse and a stupider book. Mike at least isn't dumb. It seems to me that the old rule is goodwill, important as it is, in the lack of a good analysis, is always going to go wrong. You can have the best will in the world, and what you actually do is going to be useless, counterproductive, or nonsensical unless you understand what's going on. And what the just war tradition does, seem to me, is to try to take the real existing circumstances and say, what do we do in this case?
Commercial radio doesn't have to give equal time. Does pirate radio have to give equal time to, like, Elfstein?
No.
Okay.
She has more than equal. She has far too much equal time because of that. Because of the propagandist aspect of what she does.
I think part of the problem too is that it's not as simple as one side or the other in this situation. I think we tend to want to gravitate and polarize ourselves to feel comfortable in having a black and white issue, when really it's always pretty gray. And that's the things with most things in life. And the thing reality is that we come to think about this war and all the presuppositions and causes for the war, you can really turn the tables quite easily and see that there's not a lot of differences in a lot of ways. We want to get real political and think about different types of socialistic or communistic or whatever mindsets, but the reality is that we get on Saddam Hussein, rightfully so, for being a terrorist, a dictator who don't care about people, and so on and so forth, because that's the way his government's set up. But you really look at the American government, how it's set up, there's very few people in power, similar to any other country in the world, and there are people who are hurting, there are people who are starving, people that you feed at the Catholic worker house that need help, while there are others that live in billion-dollar houses and so on and so forth. So we are so quick to judge when we actually resemble a lot of the things that we're so against. And again, I'm not saying that this person's right, that person's wrong, or any other way, but we really need to take a step back and analyze how we think about things and how we view others in this light. And as an African-American male, and you talk about anything that says just in front of it, there's about a million different things that are wrapped up into that too, that are not as, you know, as clearly defined as we like them to be as well. You know, technically we have equal protection, equal rights in this country, but the reality is that's not true. I can go on till the cow comes home in terms of how many statistics are out there that lets us know that there's not equality in this country. So when we start getting to the just, we got to start asking ourselves, well, who is defining what just is, and where we go from there. But again, overall, the question is not that simple. It's a lot of gray area, and you got to be real careful when you polarize yourself to one side or the other.
Well, as far as polarization, I think part and parcel of Christianity is, in fact, a polarization. I'll disagree with that. I think that Jesus said he came not to bring peace but the sword. Obviously, not a literal sword. Hey, I'll throw out all. See, the thing is, the pacifism is grounded pure and simple in the life and death and resurrection of Jesus Christ. Pure and simple, Jesus Christ is the norm. And what he and how he, you know, when looking at Jesus, he, you know, we say he's the Son of God, because when we look at Jesus, he is God. And so I can't understand how you can look away from the cross to, you know, the seven criteria of the just war theory when you have Mike Novak going to Rome, you know, trying to convince all the, you know, head people at the Vatican that in fact the war is just. It opens it up to this relativity when I think the gospel is clear. The New Testament is clear. The gospel is on the side of peace in every way. There, of course, in the Old Testament there is some you know, justification for war there, but I think everything is read through the cross. That's the grounding for pacifism, and I realize that people can get slaughtered because of that. It's not politically, you know, the smartest thing to do, looking at it from a completely secular view. But I think once the cross, that opens things up, and I don't think there's anything worth killing for. I think there's lots of things worth dying for.
I just wanted to ask you something though. How do you deal with the things that are in the Old Testament? I mean, if you believe in the cross, you believe in Jesus, you also believe in the Bible, the entire Bible, and you believe in God and the nature of God and things of that and all that. And there's lots of things in the Old Testament that really, frankly, they're hard to swallow. I mean, when you think of Elijah having a grizzly bear eat up some children, you know, it's like, wow, you know. So how do you deal with that? You know, but that is somewhere, that's part of God's nature, because the Old Testament is, you know, part of that story. So how do you reconcile that, I guess?
I reconcile it because everything is read through the cross. Jesus himself said, well, it was once said unto you, you know, an eye for an eye, tooth for a tooth, but I say to you, do not resist evil. Do not resist evil. He's clearly, you know, trumping what the Old Testament is saying on this. He's arguing hermeneutics. He's arguing interpretation. How do you interpret the Old Testament? He's saying it's clearly on the side of the of nonviolence. So, and he embodied that in the cross. So, but I mean, we could argue this.
Well, I certainly wouldn't want to do that. But then, right after that quote, it's not long before Jesus is taking a whip and driving money changers out of the temple. And I think when you've got economic power and you have injustice, whether it's in a democratic culture or an authoritarian culture, there comes time when we have to decide, okay, how do we respond? What do we do about it? And just practically, I think that second step is harder. Sure, bind up the wounds of those who are suffering, provide food and shelter. But then how do you think about economic injustice? How can Christians organize, whether it's in an army or demonstration, to respond to those things that are causing that? That's what continues to motivate me to try to think about these things and work with other people who are trying to think about these things.
Some of your solutions?
Well, I think it's often very hard. But in terms of economics, for example, when there's prejudice against African Americans, Latinos, women, I think the Christian church has to do several things. One, it has to provide a model. It has to say, okay, here at least is a place where people are treated equally. Here's a place where people are allowed to grow and bloom and develop and achieve. And the church at its best, I think, can do that. And then I think it has to look at the society and see a way to organize and economically to provide. Well, I know a guy in Marion, Illinois, you know, who goes to Africa and uses money from people in this country to build wells so that people can have safe drinking water, their kids, you know, it's something very, very practical, but it's making a difference at several levels, and it's, in a sense, taking from a wealthy culture some of the resources and getting them where they're needed. That'll just be a couple of quick thoughts.
My thoughts are even disconnected. I'm thinking back to Carl's earlier comment about the politics of any ethical stance, and that really reminds me of how I've come to understand pacifism as not an apolitical activity, but as a very active activity. That was something that I learned from reading John Howard Yoder, was just that pacifism is not to step out, and
it's not
of the conversation, but it is to be in it. It's to be in it, but maybe working towards a different end. Maybe sometimes not believing that the kingdom is going to be synonymous before Christ returns, to what I think. I think if I understand something of my history of right, the evangelical church in America being passive and removed from, understand right, that there was some of the revivals around the 60s and 70s saw evangelical Christians saying, hey, we actually can be involved and we can be out of it. And so that ended up taking the form of, you know, what we saw during the Roe v. Wade controversy and ever since, and that the Christian right's really risen out of that, and that part of that problem with what happened in that history has been that they understood pacifism wrong in the first place, and they understand what they're aiming towards wrong. And second, they're trying to build the kingdom of man out of not having understood even exactly what they live in the first place. But I think there's some better historians of
historical comment I wanted to mention was Jeff's remark. The Old Testament, which seems to me the best short description I've ever heard from a Christian on how to handle the question of the food laws or the kosher laws of the Old Testament. Jeff said, there are some things in the Old Testament hard to swallow. I like that. I'm going to use that.
Right, yeah, killing for all these ridiculous things.
It to go back to our starting point in terms of progressive Christianity, what it means to be a Christian, it seems to me it's fairly close to the center of the gospel, that to be a Christian is to take the meaning of one's life not from the current political and social circumstances, but precisely from the kingdom of God. And that Eric's point about peace being a paramount characteristic of the kingdom, I think is absolutely right. I mean, I think that's where you begin. But there is a much abused intellectual process that's necessary here. It's called casuistry. And casuistry is the business of applying principles to particular cases. And it isn't easy. The pacifism argument takes its characteristic form in the writings of St. Augustine, or Augustine, if you prefer. I have a friend who says the only real difference between Catholics and Protestants these days is Catholics say Augustine and Protestants say Augustine. But in any case, in there, he considers the demand for peace, the demand for nonviolence, the demand for non-retaliation. Right. And he says, yes, that's exactly right. That's the idea. That is the king that characterizes the kingdom, the city of God, as you say, which is more or less what he means by king. But he says, what happens when your neighbor is abusing his child? What happens when you see a poor man fallen among thieves, not before you got there, but as you get there? And out of that, he generates that. But that, once we put that into the communal context that I suggested before, I think in some sense the modern genius is to turn all communal questions into questions of individual action, and there's a mistake here, because what we're talking about is Augustine's question, what happens when we see violence being done that we can affect? Do we hold back, or is it in fact incumbent upon us to be involved? Now, revolutionary violence, which I think is the only violence that's justified by the just war tradition, revolutionary violence is always defensive. That is, it's violence against the violence that's been initiated by an oppressive and unjust situation. And it's in response to that. Well, perhaps World War II is a difficult case, as we all know. But I think in fact that probably becomes that in terms of the opposition to fascism. Revolutionary violence would be, for example, the violence of a resistor against an invader. An invading army is in your country abusing your people. Do you have the right to shoot at them from behind walls? Yes, you do.
Can I just address that briefly? Well, going back to Jesus Christ himself, first century Palestine, the Roman imperial presence was definitely there. Lots of brutality for sure. We know that. What did Jesus do? He said, love your enemy, and he died on a cross. I mean, no doubt he was resisting their order through the cross and through his life as well. I mean, when he went into the temple and he turned the tables over, far from being a connection to, invading Iraq, I think it's he was directly confronting an exploitative structure there. And, but not arms against the temple. He instead allowed himself to be picked up by the authorities, and he died on a cross, and that's the triumph.
Some sound effect. Enough with like that.
Well, a couple things I want to address. First of all, you got to be careful of saying that Jesus trumped the Old Testament, because he didn't really trump it. He clarified a lot of things that you got to realize that they had 400 some odd laws to start with, but then the Pharisees throughout that time added about 5,600 more of them, literally. And Jesus is addressing and clarifying a lot of things that they have kind of went off the deep end with. I mean, some of the laws were just absolutely absurd, and Jesus was kind of addressing that. And that saying that he said, okay, you can go to war, he did say you live by the sword, you die by the sword. And I totally agree with you in that in the ideal world and in the way Christ wants it, that we would not have any war. We wouldn't even have an aggressive discussion because we all get along and we all are under the same canopy. Outside of Jesus Christ, there was no other example in the Bible or outside the Bible that we can see that lived that perfectly. So therefore, there must be something to living in this world that we have to deal with that's a little bit unique to us that it was to Jesus. And that's the question I said that's not easy to answer, because it's not as clear as that. If it was, it, you know, God probably would have worked it out where he didn't have to kill any other people in the Old Testament. I mean, it wouldn't be slavery as we know it in any way, shape, or form in the Old Testament or even New Testament. That's another question you could ask yourself there, too. Slavery was very common in the New Testament. There's no quotes from Jesus saying slavery is absolutely wrong. Now, granted, slavery was different then than it is in our connotation of it, but yet there was still lots of atrocities being done, and we just don't hear a lot about what Jesus had to say about it. Right, and so the African American slave.
Revolt, kill him.
No, he didn't. But in the case of the African American slave, so do you sit for the 400 years that we're in slavery, and then add on the for the rest of the existence of the African American population to stay in slavery and go with? I don't think that's what God will want either. Yeah, it's all under the goodness of their heart. So there's lots of things that's wrapped up into this. I'm just saying it's not as simple as just being pacifist. I do believe that we are a peaceful world. We are to be able to work things out without violence, and we are supposed to do these things. But again, airplanes weren't supposed to go into those buildings on September 11th either. So there's something to it, a little bit deeper, a little bit more to it than what we're offering right now.
We're all agreed that, peace is obviously the way. The only thing, from your pulpit, did you say that the war is okay?
Oh, no.
Okay. All right. Well, then we're all on the same page. Goes.
It's a mass destruction.
As far as I'm concerned, Christian political...
Iraq didn't have it, but what if some...
I would have to go back with that one. I would have to go back to who has the right to have nuclear arms. We're the only ones actually. If you want to go with track record, then somebody should be taking ours away from us. So I think as to, again, to have it, who's not right. But again, you answer that just question again, and I wonder how that works out, because in Saddam Hussein's case, we were ready after to jump right in there, but then you got this guy in North Korea who has nuclear capabilities to reach Hawaii right now, and a couple more years can reach the continent of the United States, and all we're saying, all we're talking about is peace in that situation. So again, it goes deeper than just this, should we, make ourselves safe from that. There's more to it than that. There's lots of underlying plots that we're not aware of that's making all this just stuff actually not really be, is really a fallacy in a lot of ways.
Let's talk a little bit about, since Sarah asked this at the beginning, what should Christians do separately or together when, like we are, we're in a country that does have weapons of mass destruction. We're in a country that's the most powerful in the world and most likely powerful. And when we look at millions of people around the world who aren't like people, the majority of people live in America, what is the right thing for us to do in terms of influencing our political process in the justice from the Christian perspective?
Well, It's a rather kind of grand question, and it's tough to think about on a grand scale. That's why I think about it on a much smaller scale in terms of how I live at the Catholic Worker House. I think voluntary poverty is part and parcel of the revolution of the kingdom, because the fact is we're all around the world fighting these wars. I mean, Bush said it himself, for our way of life. If we simply withdraw, I make less than $7,000 a year. I do not pay taxes for war. That's a political move.
You also simplifying don't pay taxes for social services.
Well, that's the thing. I do it myself. I feed people myself. I mean, I don't need to look to the government for that. Christian,
I donate more than you do.
Oh, I know you donate. I know you donate more than I do. But Phil Berrigan said, "Your hope is where your ass is." My hope is with the poor, with the down and out, with the folks that Jesus hung out with. And I think part and parcel of this revolution has to be, you can call it lifestyle politics. I think it has to extend beyond that. But to think about personally, as far as social change, for me, simple living is just essential.
question about that. Something awfully hard for most people to stomach.
Well,
it's, you know, if Christians are going to be a substantial force for progressive or radical social change, they need to be able to make alliances among themselves as well as with non-Christians. So how would your very strong feelings about how you want to live and the sense that that is the best way to subvert or to change the system relate to other people who would see that as intimidating or maybe even self-righteous?
Well, I think you start here. You start talking to people about it. I think, you know, if Christian, you know, there's going to be alliances with non-Christians. I agree with that. And they may not be able to stomach the voluntary poverty thing. But Christians have to, I think. You know, Jesus, again, I hate to sound like this black and white kind of guy, but, you know, Jesus was pretty clear cut on possessions. They're pretty bad. So that's where you go from there. I mean, you know, we can take a look at the
I think getting caught up on that is missing the point. I just read in church this morning the story about the rich ruler who talked to Jesus and like, what I need to do to inherit eternal life. And Jesus, you know, follow the law. So he said, yeah, I've been following them since I've been a boy. Okay, it was one thing you got left. Give away all you have and give it to the poor. And he couldn't do it. And he was sad because he couldn't do it. Here is the answer to eternal life. And he couldn't follow through. But right. But here's the thing. The point is, it goes beyond just this guy giving away his stuff, though. The point of that story is that Jesus want us to have him as center. That doesn't necessarily mean we're, you know, take a vow of poverty. That's fine if you make a personal choice to do that. But to take it universally, that's not the case. God's Jesus' point there is that I have to be number one. And if you can't have millions of dollars to make me number one, then you got a problem. But I don't think he said you do have millions of dollars and you can't, and you still could put me number one, that's a problem. I think that's that. I don't, again, that part gets fuzzy. Not necessarily. I think God is calling all of us as Christians to be guided and led by the Holy Spirit. And if I am a multimillionaire, there's a lot more I can do for the kingdom than if I wasn't a multimillionaire. And again, the key is not to get caught up on how much money you have or what your politics are, but to be led and guided by the Holy Spirit to do whatever God is calling you to do. You know, Jesus hung around all types of people. He hung around the poor, but he also had some wealthy friends, too. I mean, and he didn't, you know, say all of them are going to hell. So he wants people to be in all these different areas of life and all these genres of population so that all can be reached. That's the point. You know, a person making $7,000 a year probably is going to have a hard time convincing a multi-billionaire about Christ because they're not going to see eye to eye. But God wants multi-billionaires too, so he can see eye to eye with that person and bring him to the gospel as well.
Proportional giving. I'm in proportion, yeah, right. I think Eric actually has a comeback to you, Jeff, on the passage that you're working on here. Because, of course, what Jesus says at the end is, go sell all you have, give to the poor, and come follow me.
Right.
You know, and back to our notions of what counts as Christianity, all of us would say, I think, that finally what Christianity means is following Christ. That's fine. But what does that mean in practice? There's where the real issues come. How does that work out when we try to say, okay, living where I am, doing what I am now, you know, what does taking the meaning of one's life from the kingdom, which I could take to be synonymous with following Jesus, what does that mean? And it's not an easy question. It's not even a question that you can answer with a general rule, much less with bromides. I mean, it means you've got to do politics. You've got to talk about what the real situation is. Is it really the case that the U.S. was threatened by weapons of mass destruction by the government of Iraq, and therefore we get to kill 20,000 people? No, that's wrong, by the way. But it's wrong only when you point out, you know, the specifics of why it's wrong, the reason you have to do politics. The word was, I think it was probably Eric again who introduced the word radical, to talk about radical politics. Those of us of a certain age were probably more familiar with that word than others, but I mean, its meaning is funny. I mean, etymologically, it comes from the word for root. You know, I mean, these things have radices, they got roots. You're radical when you go to the root of the matter, and they're talking there about politics. What is the root of the matter? What is the nature of capitalism? What is the nature of capitalism in our world? Probably not the same as it was the last century. And what does that mean in terms of the politics of a particular state for which we have a responsibility as citizens? What does that mean for the policies followed by the Bush administration? And what then is to be done, to coin a phrase? Those are the questions that the progressive Christian has to answer, and they're political questions, and they ain't easy.
Well, as the token rich Presbyterian in the circle here, the church of bankers, lawyers, doctors, I mentioned proportional giving earlier as I think a sensible way for people in wealthy countries and or wealthy people anywhere to think about their responsibility as a Christian. I think, to quote again, those to whom much is given, much is required. And I think if people have assets, whether they're educational assets, whether they're the kind of assets of a strong family, whether they're monetary assets, whether the ability to make a good or great living, that means that you have all those things that you have to think about in terms of what does it mean that I'm a Christian with those assets, and how do I pass them on, how do I share them, how do I give them away to others. I think those are ethical questions. And I guess I disagree with something Carl said a long time ago. I think ethics is where the gospel starts. I think it's not so important who Jesus was. I think it's much more important what Jesus showed us and told us to do.
Sometimes,
that's
actually what I meant. I think the real disagreement around this circle is more not about progressivity. We can argue about what the politics suggest one way or another, but about what Christianity is. And on that, you've put your finger on it there, I think.
But related to that, one of the things that's very encouraging to me about this conversation is that I think we spend more time talking about what I would consider to be eschatology and its practical application. That is, what are we working towards? What do we believe? Where do we believe the kingdom of God is? And when is it going to come about? That's why I tried to just there define it. That is, I just said, when is Christ coming back? And what is that we believe is going to happen? Yeah. And that's encouraging to me that we're talking about that, because most of the time when I get together with people who identify themselves as radical Christians, we spend more time talking about what makes us radical compared to the rest of the Christians, which you brought up very early in there. not around here. One other thing that I'd be...
Don't despair, Eric.
Well, we got to get together.
Get your lantern and get out there.
One thing, I don't know, Sarah, you might... I'm not sure if you'd want to turn it this way, but one of the things that I'm really curious about is how your thesis work and what you've been writing and some of the background for this project that we're here a part of, I think, is very very related to this discussion and your work in looking at sort of two different models of activism, this viral resistance that they're writing about compared to the old waiting outside the bunker model, I think is really related and maybe even happens at the same time as this discussion. I wonder if you might be willing to just say anything about that here as a way of
summarize. As part of my MFA work, of which this conversation is a piece as well, I wrote a rather lengthy paper contrasting two different forms, or rather than contrasting two different forms, trying to elaborate a set of criteria or a way of understanding a certain form of cultural political resistance that I termed viral, in that it works to spread itself out from a number of different sources and operates at many places and in many areas simultaneously, rather than locating, there's a source of power, we're going to go to that source of power and take some of it from it. And there can be an element of that waiting outside the bunker. I mean, I want to point out at least some point in this conversation that we are sitting on a little parklet owned by Covenant Medical Center, which is, you know, ostensibly at least a religious hospital, but has received a great deal of attention for medical debt collection practices that really harm the poor. So we're in some ways in a of sitting outside a bunker, a power bunker, but what we're engaged in, what we're doing, is a transactional experience that is a manifestation of some kind of general being against. I don't know if that is a good enough summary or not.
I was just that into the discussion because of that. That's the activist part of the discussion that doesn't always take place at the same time as the Christianity part of the discussion. And one of the things I'm really happy about your choice of including this is allowing us to see just how much these two discussions have to say to each other.
Your viral model, Sarah, puts me in mind of a remark of Noam Chomsky's, and I was talking earlier about the necessity of trying to talk about what politics means on the ground. I think one of the people who's done a great deal on that subject in the last generation is Noam Chomsky. I find him always a provocative guide on these matters. Yeah, a prophet, yeah, very definitely, without honor in his own country, I might add. He once said, he had his radical friends, I don't even know that we used the word, you know, who say the job is to speak truth to power. In fact, I believe, if I remember the context, he's talking particularly about Quakers, Quaker friends, people he knows politics with from the Quaker tradition, who are saying our task is to speak truth to power. He said, I disagree. He says, that's not the point. First of all, power already knows the truth. You know, that's what they're in the business of hiding and misrepresenting and so forth. So speaking it to them doesn't tell them anything that they don't already know. Secondly, the people who need to know the truth are those who are being misled by those in power, that is, everyone else. And your viral theory, if I understand it correctly, is a response, in a sense, to Chomsky's analysis there. I think perhaps, maybe even in the Christian tradition, we make too much of this notion of speaking truth to power. Who we need to talk to, the late anarchist Carl Hess, a guy I found very interesting. He started life as a speechwriter for Barry Goldwater and moved steadily left and ended up as one of the major anarchist thinkers of the American 20th century. Carl Hess said, the world is in such a state that the most revolutionary thing you can ever do is get to know your neighbor. That's a viral system, it seems to me.
Notion that actually binding up the wounds of the poor and feeding the hungry is counter-revolutionary, and that the activists who are trying to get people motivated to actually attack some of the causes of evil, instead you need to rub raw the sores of discontent as some of the community organizers have written and said.
Well, I'm going to say real quickly, I think some of that's manifested, again, I go back to this health center, because it's something that we have people we consider on both sides of the tracks that's involved, you know, whether it be Champaign County healthcare consumers that are supportive, or Provena or Carl, who are very supportive, you know, and at this point, when you got something higher to look upon, in this case, providing healthcare for the poor, which people can relate to, whether you're Christian or not, then I think that's when you can get around a lot of that, and you can kind of go beyond what you're talking about in terms of rubbing each other the wrong way, but you can actually focus on something bigger and more important and be able to work together in that. And I've seen it happen, so that's why I speak on it. And I tend not to want to take a very antagonistic view in us versus them kind of thing, because I really believe the true way of getting it done is for everybody to be working together on things.
Getting something done ends up sort of improving the image for a group, or for example, you know, the classic example would be greenwashing, like Exxon's ads showing lovely, beautiful nature just came out a few months after they spilled oil all over it. And it seems that some of those kind of strategic alliances, while, you know, really beneficial for getting a health center started or getting, a home built, it's one home and it's one health center, and then the practices and the structure sort of continues unabated. And I think that was a little bit of what you were getting at, if I don't...
Yeah, I think so. I mean, Saul Alinsky, for example, when he was organizing people in the south side and west side of Chicago, felt that you needed to make things worse before people would be motivated enough to try to make the huge changes that were required to deal with the bureaucracies in the city of Chicago.
Go ahead. Well, I mean, I guess to a degree, I'm kind of alienated from the discussion of social change because it boils down to being effective. How can we be most effective? And I'm not sure that's the question to be asked. I mean, implicit in what you're saying is, you know, by feeding the poor, housing the homeless, maybe we are, you know, creating more of a problem by not addressing the solution or, you know, taking care of these people so that people are saying, well, someone's taking care of it, it's not a problem, instead of just letting them go. But I think back to the parable of the Great Judgment, Matthew 25, one of the foundational texts of the Catholic workers. You know, fundamentally, we are judged on what we have done to the least of these, which, you know, the hungry, the poor, you know, the prisoner, the sick. And that's why, you know, the idea of social change being effective, you know, I'm not sure in my idea of Christianity that it can fully belong, because, I mean, Jesus died on a cross. I mean, not very effective. You know, he died just kind of an embarrassment. But God did something with that. You know, that was a climactic moment, the climactic moment, Christians believe, in all of history. And so I think that in this weakness, you know, I think the movement to the margins, you know, we have to stop, you know, a piece of power. I don't want any power. I want to flee from power. But I think paradoxically, that might be the way to get power, not us, but God.
Steve raises the question of the interaction of reform and revolution, of whether, in fact, ameliorating short-term problems may not be finally simply protecting the underlying structural evils and so forth. It's a serious question, I think, but I think the people who raise it often do it from, you know, interestingly, it's certainly not Steve's, is that... well, look, things really aren't bad enough, so therefore we've got to try to emphasize the way in which they're bad or make them look worse in order for people really to get upset about, you know, the evils that do exist in the situation. There's a sort of optimism buried in the view that Steve sketches, that things really aren't quite that bad, and therefore we have to emphasize it. I don't think we need to worry about that. Things really are that bad. And, you know, the problem of putting a Band-Aid on these problems and therefore misleading people into thinking things are okay, that's not it. That's not the issue. Telling the truth, describing... breaking through that massive facade of misrepresentation that exists. I mean, society spends $1.6 trillion each year to convince people about the way the society is structured. We call it marketing or PR or something of that sort, you know. But you can't spend that much money and not be effective. They are effective. And it's breaking through that. It's finding some way to take principles from elsewhere, for Christians clearly from the kingdom of God, and to try to say, no, that's, you know, you're being massively misled. That's the issue. That's why you're virus theory, I think, is interesting. Okay. Oh, sorry, Jeff.
Back in addressing what you're talking about, too, in terms of effectiveness, I mean, frankly, Jesus Christ down on the cross was tremendously effective. Right. It was through his resurrection, because there had been other rebel leaders before who died, and they stayed dead. But that was the difference with Jesus. And, you know, one of the senior pastors of the church, when he says that when you know somebody's willing to give their life for something, that goes so much, much further than anything you can say to that person. and that's one of the ways that how Jesus was very effective in dying for what he believed in, and how disciples and everybody else follow after that example. And in terms of the effectiveness, despite the fact that we're working with all different types of agencies and different types of people with the health center, we're going to be able to be on the grassroots front lines, being able to minister to people.
I'm not dogging what you're doing. That's where it's at.
But I can guarantee you, though, that if we had not worked with all these different groups and Pravina and Carl and other people like that, it probably wouldn't happen.
It's not against us.
Yeah.
Us.
And so, again, it's not as simple as the power versus the rest of everybody else, because it's people and it's individuals and it's relationships and it's individual circumstances and situations that we have to look at one-on-one. It's almost like, you know, why we can't stereotype, because, you know, you may see me and you may come up with all kind of thoughts of what what I may be because I'm an African-American male, but I may be very different than what you imagine. And that's how a lot of this kind of stuff is. And we got to see beyond that, especially as Christians, because that's what Christ calls us to do, is not be any respective person. So that's part of what this is all about. Now, why I get excited about this kind of discussion, because I think we can include more people in that process and break down all these walls that we tend to put up.
Yeah, I think I really appreciate this bringing up this notion of effectiveness into the conversation, because I think it's true that Christ's death on the cross was ultimately effective, but it's also true that within the time in which he did that, people were really longing for him to be effective in a way that was going to kick out the empire, and that what he did was as is all the kingdom of God, it doesn't make sense by the ways that power works, and that's contradictions that I have trouble understanding, but which I'm very thankful for. And in the end, I end up wanting to shift discussions of social change away from effectiveness and more towards obedience and stewardship. Like not, you know, not so much thinking about that outcome as often as how are we using what we have available to us in a way, and that to me starts to get away from an idea of trying to ultimately get the power in order to make the change somehow.
Are you all at all worried about creeping Mel Gibsonism?
Yeah.
I mean, you know, this business. I mean, there's. I was thinking as you were talking, Jeff. There's some danger in this talk about the sort of significance garnered by being willing to give one's life. The 9/11 attackers were all of them, or at least most of them, as far as we know, willing to give their lives. Suicide bombers are willing to give their lives. We may have criticisms. I wonder about that, actually, whether it's quite the same thing. But some are. I mean, they're clearly clearly are. And it seems to me that you know, we might raise some real issues about what we conclude about their actions from the willingness. An amazing case this last weekend, this football player, Pat Tillman, who was killed in Afghanistan, was being trumpeted by the State Department as a hero. He turned down $3.6 million as an NFL star to fight for freedom in Afghanistan. Well, yes. A kid at University of Massachusetts wrote an editorial in the student paper saying, look, Tillman was no hero. He wasn't defending freedom. You know, he was going off. He was being a Rambo in Afghanistan, and they blew his head off. So to make him a hero is nonsense. The president of the University of Massachusetts has now sent a circular letter disavowing the column in the student paper because this student had the temerity to say Pat Tillman wasn't a hero. I mean, I think, you know, and perhaps Christians particularly should be concerned about, you know, willingness to give one's life. Mel Gibson thinks that, I mean, it becomes sadomasochism, I think, in Gibson's portrayal, more the material for the analyst's couch than for the theologian's study. But his Christ is precisely willing to give his life and being tortured, one thinks, perhaps for Mel's delectation.
In terms of giving, I think the motivations, I mean, you look at someone like Kathy Kelly. For me, Kathy Kelly embodies who Christ is. She was willing to put her life on the line, going to live with the enemy, with the poor there, and risking her life. But she was not willing to take anyone's life in that process, unlike Pat Tillman, unlike the people who of 9/11. So that's what I think that is distinguishing mark is. But I think for peace, if people are, you know, however many troops, you know, obviously not all of them are willing to give up their lives, but a lot of them are. I think the peace movement has to be the same way. Until people start saying, I'm willing to put my life on the line, forget about it. You can't challenge it.
But of course, Jesus didn't want to die. And we know in the garden he said, if it's possible, may this cup pass from me. I think life is the ultimate good. And may not be the ultimate evil. Maybe there are things worse than that, like apathy. But I think... I think that to respond to Carl's point about Gibson's movie and The Passion and all the focus that's been here on the death of Christ, it seemed to me that the life of Christ was much more important. And it seemed to me that he thought so too.
Well, I like to think that he did, but that 30 seconds of resurrection clip footage didn't convince me of that. But again, one of the other things I do want to address too, in terms of effectiveness that you mentioned earlier, I think about two examples of power. Martin Luther King Jr. and Adolf Hitler, both people with tremendous power. One decided to use his gifts and his abilities for good. One obviously decided to use his gifts and abilities for evil. You know, so again, to me, it is not even a matter of power, being in power, not being in power. It's a matter of leading. And if you're being led and you're doing what Christ is calling you to do.
Just put one more foot, Eric, the last word. It seemed to me the gospel writers also know that the life of Christ is more important because they give you 28 chapters for their 25 chapters for that and only 3 for the Passion.
I just think one of the ways in which death gets overemphasized and martyrdom gets overemphasized as the good is when it's emphasized out of context, and that it's not that Christ died, but it's that he died, you know, being commanded by his Father to do so, and for specific, you know, and for a specific sacrifice. Well, that's what happened in the garden, was when he had the struggle, right?
In the Garden of Gethsemane, you know, take this cup from me. You know, he's talking about, you know, but through this death, there was this overcoming of the imperial powers. But I don't think it's wanting to die. It's a willingness to die. Jesus was willing to die. He wasn't going around looking to die. It was a natural consequence of his radical stance. I think for him it was either the cross or the sword, you know?
Hypothesis.
Yeah.
Thing it up.
But one more point, since Carl brought up this category of other martyrs that are celebrated, it seems like, okay, I haven't seen The Passion, so I can't speak with...
I refuse to.
Yes, with any kind of authority on this, but from all the hubbub, it sounds like Christ's death there is more allied with the death of the celebrated Columbine victims, that they died. A couple of these victims have really acquired a lot of cogency and attention in some of the evangelical circles, right? Youth groups kind of organizing themselves around, you know, will you make sure that you affirm Christ when the boys in black coats come to blow your head off? And it's a sense in which maybe the willingness to die is more a way of identifying yourself on a particular side of a cultural divide than out of a specific task or obedience.
Ladies and gentlemen, at the heart of the gospel is not the death of Christ.
Yeah.
It's not the crucifixion. At the heart of the gospel is not, and I differ with Steve on this, I think even finally the life of Christ. Now, obviously, the crucifixion and the life of Christ are vital for, you know, how we understand Christianity. But at the heart of the gospel is the resurrection. That is the point, and I think you're quite right, Jeff, in pointing out how scanted it is in the Gibson. The movie is about something else. It's not about the heart of the gospel. It's not about Christianity. The resurrection, even in the gospels themselves,
which are in some sense accidental documents, as you know. I mean, the original Christian writings are not Gospels. It was only after the first generation began dying off and people said, damn, we better put down some of these stories we've been telling to one another, you know, that they decided that the Gospel form sort of observed. That wasn't Christian. Christians lived and died without ever having seen a New Testament or a Gospel or anything of that sort. What they heard was the preaching of the Gospel, which was the preaching of the resurrection, that God has decisively intervened in this Christ-killing world, that you could stake your life on it, you could give up your life for it, and that he had made this clear in the case of Jesus, that Jesus was the firstborn from among the dead, was the way it was preached. As he is, so shall we be. It's the coming of the kingdom, which is another way to say the resurrection, that's the heart of it. Well, I'm not a Pelagian at all. I don't get there by my efforts, you know. I mean, bringing me to the kingdom is God's business. In the meantime, I have some political problems.
Right. I keep feeling a few raindrops, but this has been incredibly educational for me, and I really want to thank all of you for coming here. So I don't know if anyone has any last things to say.
Thank you for instigating.
Thank you, Sarah.
Indeed, Sarah. It's brilliant to do it.
I hope that people can sort of virally scatter and somehow take this away with you or continue talking outside of my initiative. Thanks a lot.